physical suffering draws out something in us, doesn't it? It can draw out the worst in us, and it can draw out the best in us. Perhaps you have seen before someone go through physical suffering, some sort of illness or crippling, you know, circumstance, and they went through it with a bad attitude. I've seen this a lot, and people go through it with a bad attitude. The attitude gets worse. They vent toward God, "Why are you doing this to me?" And I've seen actually a number of people over the years leave the faith because they just couldn't make sense of the suffering. Conversely, have you ever seen somebody go through a time of great physical pain and suffering and had a good attitude, had great grace and beauty and peace on them? Have you seen that before? I've seen as much of this as I have the other. I remember actually a teacher that I'm quite fond of. Her name is Marva Dawn. She's a Bible scholar, and she has perhaps been through more physical suffering than anyone I have ever heard of. She is a Bible teacher of really high repute. She's gifted, but she has gone through over and over again enough suffering that it would fill 10 lifetimes of normal people. Kind of incredible. She's a diabetic, and her legs are giving out on her. She's up in age at this point in time, but her legs have been giving out since she was in high school. They gave all kinds of bad diagnosis on that. She's tippy. She falls over quite a bit. She injures herself with that. Her eyes, one of her eyes just started bleeding randomly. They thought they were going to have to take it out, but then the Lord actually helped to stop that, the healing and that whole thing, but she sees very poorly, and she's a scholar, and scholars read. So it's like, what do you do with that? Not only that, but her organs began to fail years ago, and she's just had one thing after another, and then on top of that, a few years ago, she came down with cancer. And she's still alive to this day. And I just think, wow, what in the world, God, are you doing? This is a woman who's given her life to teaching people about you. And she's going through all of this suffering. And she is probably more than anyone I have ever heard talk, she's the most generous and gracious and gentle soul. And the suffering that she has gone through has done something beautiful and redemptive in her. Really incredible. How do you respond when you go through physical pain and suffering? Think for a moment. How do you respond when you go through physical pain and suffering? It's difficult, isn't it? Something unique about this that gets kind of to the core of who we are. We're in a study in the book of Job, as I prayed before, and in that study, we're focusing on thinking about suffering with faith and truth. Last week we saw from Job 1 that the Bible actually doesn't give us one cohesive answer in terms of the problem of suffering and the problem of evil. Rather, it gives sort of a mosaic of answers, of which all of them are incomplete in themselves. And I don't even think that they give, on the whole, a complete picture either. It's a sort of a holy, a W-H-O-L-L-Y, mosaic, but that's what the Bible gives us nonetheless. Last week we saw from Job 1 that in terms of what Job is teaching us about this, the book of Job, that the invisible realm can directly interact with the visible realm and cause suffering. That's one of the causes of suffering. That God permits and limits the scope of that interaction, that suffering has a way of revealing what's inside of us, and that we can experience devastating loss and still trust God and His goodness. This morning, out of the book of Job, we're going to be looking at physical suffering and our responses to it. And the big idea that we'll see here is that in the midst of our physical pain, suffering, and loss, remaining faithful to God, focused on and loyal to Him, is our bullseye. That's our bullseye. Let me say it one more time. That in the midst of our physical pain and suffering and loss, remaining faithful to God, focusing on and loyal to Him, that is our bullseye. That's the target that we're aiming at. Now, this first part of chapter 2, the first number of verses here, I think 4 verses or 3, is almost a carbon copy of chapter 1, verses 6 through 8. And the narrator begins this way. On another day, The angels came to present themselves before the Lord and the Satan. Remember, we saw that last week there's a definite article in this that makes this a title, not a proper name. So a capital S is not the right translation for this. It's the Satan. So I'm going to use that throughout as I read this. And the Satan, the accuser, the provocateur, also came with them to present himself before him, before God. And the Lord said to the Satan, "Where have you come from?" The Satan answered, "From roaming throughout the earth, going back and forth on it." And then the Lord said, "Have you considered my servant Job? There is no one on earth like him. He is blameless and upright, a man who fears God and shuns evil. And he still maintains, he holds fast, he persists his integrity, though you incited me against him to ruin or destroy him without any reason." So Job here, we're seeing at the very start of this that Job is crushed. He's lost his kids. He's lost pretty much all of his possessions. He is in a crushed state right now. But and the Satan, the accuser in this story here, has said, Job's working the system, and if you pull this rug out from under him, it will expose that he's working the system. But instead, what it shows is that Job is actually a man of integrity and faithfulness to God. But in the midst of hardship and loss, what is God looking for from us? Think about that for a moment. In the midst of our suffering and loss, what is God actually looking for? Is he looking for perfection, that we just kind of are really good soldiers in this? Is he looking for a sort of a Pollyanna? Oh, it's just everything's okay. Is he looking for some particular marvelous example that we're supposed to, you know, exude at that point in time? And I think that this is relevant for us as a church, because I think a lot of times we come into church and we think, gosh, I'm going through a really hard time in my life, but I have to act like I'm not. That's like going to the hospital with a gaping wound in your back and a EMT or a technician comes up to you and says, "What can I help you with?" And you're like, "I'm good, I'm good." And then they'd say, "Well, then why are you here? What's that big old stain on your back?" "Well, it's nothing. I'm really okay. I'm okay." Do you see what I'm saying? And a lot of times we come in and we act like, and I think that it's part of this religious perception that somehow that if we're struggling, that we have to act like we're not struggling. But that's just not what the Bible actually says. And that's not what the characters of the Bible exude. No, what is God looking for? God wants you and I to remain faithful to him in the midst of our loss and our suffering, to remain faithful to him. That is loyal to him. That is faith. That's the way that we express our faith, that we cling to him. We continue to orbit around him, that even though things are falling apart and it's incredibly difficult, we stay faithful to him. This is the message of the book of Revelation. I know that a lot of people think that this is all about Christ's return, but the central message of the book of Revelation is hang in there. That God is going, God sees that you are suffering, and basically it kind of goes like this, that things are going to heat up. That's the way that it happens all throughout the book of Revelation. You're going to be attacked. Some of you are going to be killed. I haven't left you. I have not left you. In the end, I will hold evil's feet to the fire, and I will vindicate you. So keep your eyes on the prize. Keep forward thinking and hang in there. In the midst of all of this suffering, I will redeem you. But he says in the midst of all that, you know, some of you are going to be killed in the midst of that. But don't give up. Stay faithful to me. And so that's a summary in the book of Revelation, chapter 13, verse 10. God's people must be patient and remain faithful. Faithfulness is a very big deal to God. If you asked an Old Testament scholar, most Old Testament scholars, how is it that a person got saved in the Old Testament, they would say the same way that people got saved, get saved in the New Testament. They get saved by faith. They get saved by covenant faithfulness to God, by trusting God. I mean, think about it for a moment. I think that a lot of Christians have a sort of an idea that salvation only happens for people after the cross of Jesus. But then how is it that we're going to sit at table with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? How did they get there? They got there by faith. They got there by trusting God. They got there by covenant faithfulness, that they remained faithful to God. They didn't go after these other gods when things got tough. They didn't jettison God and go after something else. Instead, they stayed faithful to God. And think about it. In the book of Revelation, this faithfulness kind of call, this charge, this thing that God is saying to the people in the book through the book of Revelation is that I'm going to hold evil's feet to the fire. I'm going to hold them all to account. And this whole thing is a tremendously encouraging thing to a first century Christian in Asia Minor. And again, this is the main message of the book of Revelation. So this first thing that we see in this passage, and really a big deal throughout the entire witness of Job, is that God is looking for faithfulness to himself. He wants you to be faithful to him. And that's surprisingly simple, isn't it? Secondly, part of this, in this section, what's interesting is that the Lord actually acknowledges that the suffering that the enemy inflicted is senseless. For no reason, for no good reason. And he doesn't send it, but he will use it. And it appears in this, the way that the Satan is actually using this, is that he's trying to make it look like that God is the one who's doing it. Which is, again, the game of the evil one. So then the provocateur, the Satan, provokes further. He says this in verse 4. Skin for skin. A man will give all he has for his own life. But now, stretch out your hand and strike his flesh and bones, and he will surely curse you to your face. So notice how the Satan here wants actually to blame God for all of this stuff. He basically says this, turn up the heat, some physical pain will reveal Job's true colors. So let's see what happens. Let's roll the dice. And honestly, physical pain has this very unique way of exposing what's inside of us, doesn't it? Now, I'm going to ask you to be honest here, but not raise your hand. How many of you actually are really needy and high maintenance when you get sick? I didn't ask you to raise your hand. Well, okay, I see that hand. God bless you. God bless you. Yeah, all right. I am very high maintenance when I, and Becky, she's just like, she's a good soldier. Me, no, I'm a complete wuss in that. I said that, didn't I? Yeah, well, that would be me in that. And so this physical suffering, this physical illness, especially stomach sick, ooh, don't like that at all. But here's the Lord's response to this. The Lord said, very well then, he's in your hands. He's in your hands, but you must spare his life. And as we said before, that God permits and limits the activity, and God's limit in this particular case is you can't kill him. But you can really get to him. And this is our confidence. This is the confidence of Christians and believers throughout the ages. Our confidence is that we will not expire until God says it's okay. That somehow we're not going to expire without the permission of God. It's what I felt when I went to India 10 days after 9/11. I thought, well, wait a minute. I'm not going to expire a minute later than when God wants me to expire. That's the Christian's confidence, isn't it? Now, sometimes we don't understand why it is that way, but it is that way, that these things do not happen without God's permission and without his limitation. And so the Apostle Paul echoes this in 2 Corinthians 4, where he says, we are pressed on every side, but not crushed. We are perplexed, but not in despair. We're persecuted, but not abandoned. We're struck down, but not destroyed. That he sees that there is this sort of permission and this limitation, and yet still God is working and God is giving strength in the midst of all of it. Well, then in verse 7, the Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the crown of his head. And then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scratched himself with it as he sat in the ashes. So the Satan in this attacks Job's health. Now, curiously from this, and I think something that we need to get out of this, is that invisible evil can inflict physical suffering in the visible world. Let me say that one more time. That invisible evil can inflict physical suffering in our visible world. And that's disturbing, isn't it? But true. Disturbing, but true. That is to say that some, not all illness is demon-driven, but some of it is demonically or spiritually driven. In the New Testament, you have this idea as well, so I'm not making this up. In Luke chapter 13, there's a story with Jesus's teaching in the synagogue on the Sabbath, and it says this in verse 11 of Luke 13. Jesus saw a woman who had been crippled by a spirit or disabled by an evil spirit. And she had been bent over for 18 years. So this is a spiritual malady that's happened over 18 years and was unable to stand up straight. And when Jesus saw her, he called her over to himself and said, "Dear woman, you are healed from your sickness." Now, she's still hunched over at this point in time. Then he touched her, and instantly she could stand up straight. Now she praised God. Now, there's a bunch of things I like about this, but this particular story shows that actually the enemy can do this kind of activity. Again, we can over-extrapolate on it, but the reality is that personal malevolence, personal invisible spiritual evil can actually inflict us, even in America, in the 21st century. He could still do this. That this isn't just an ancient practice or an ancient idea. I also like it that Jesus simply pronounces her healing, that there's no pyrotechnics. She's not thrown down on the ground. She's just freed. Love that. But so how do you know the source of the affliction? How do you know? Well, I think the simple answer is this. You ask God. You ask God. Now, there are all kinds of formulas out there that want to say, if this is this, then it's always that, and if this is this, then it's always that. I've heard actually some teachers say that all sickness is of the devil. And so we must go after it with all of our faith and ferocity. The reality is, though, and I love the way that those people actually pray, because they really go after stuff like that, but not everybody is healed, because not all sickness comes from the evil one. Not all sickness is spiritually based in this sense. It's more complex than that. That sometimes an illness has some demonic fingerprint on it, and other times it doesn't. And that's just reality. Sometimes they're just germs. Sometimes you were around someone who, you know, had the flu, and you got the flu. And it wasn't a demon who did it. You were just around a person who coughed right in your face. Or you were on an airplane. That's what happened to me coming home from Vietnam, as I was on an airplane with a bunch of sick people, and I came home sick. And it wasn't the evil one. So if somebody comes to you with a broken arm that they fell off of a bicycle, are you going to say the devil did that to you? No, right? You're not going to say that, because it's not true. But on the other hand, in praying for and ministering to people with chronic back issues over a long period of time, every once in a while, sometimes there are some spiritual tentacles with that. Goes something like this, that as I have, you know, prayed for people and I've asked them questions, it's like, have you got any, you know, resentment toward either one of your parents or not? I'm like, well, they, you know, did this or that. And so as the result of this sort of stored up bitterness and resentment, it gives the enemy a landing pad. The enemy will take whatever landing pad he's got, and he will afflict in whatever ways that we give him. He will, anything that we concede, he will take, anything. It doesn't matter what culture, what country, what time period, anything you concede, the enemy will take. And the point is that we just simply don't concede those things. But the big deal is here that we need to ask God, because the enemy's domain is sin, it's evil, it's bondage. That's his domain, that's his game. And so when somebody is sick in some way that we just can't figure it out, we maybe need to ask God. Actually, I think we need to ask God all the time. But I don't assume that something is demonically driven, but I need to have the vision for, a biblical vision for the idea that the enemy actually plays in this arena as well. And I'm not unaware of his schemes. Are you with me so far? Does that make sense? Now, I'm not saying that there's a demon under every bush. And so as I thought about this message and was praying about it, and I thought, you know what, maybe I need to do another message on what is the range of the enemy's ability to get to us, but I don't want to do a sermon and focus on the devil. That would just be a bad idea. So I want to throw some things in here, and I'm going to do this very quickly, and it's in your bulletin. I've left these things in your bulletin, and I've not put any references, any Bible references in it. That's for two reasons. One, I didn't have time. That's the main reason. And the second one is because I want you to go look it up. Because if you go look it up, then you'll have to figure it out. And if you think about this, then you will own what you've learned a lot better than if I just spit it out to you. So both of those things are true. So for the sake of clarity, what can evil do in this world's realm? I think that that's part of the question that's begged in this whole thing. And I think that firstly, we need to say this straightforward, that Satan, not the Satan in this story, but Satan as Jesus refers to him in the New Testament, is a fully localized spiritual being, perhaps the top dog of the demonic pyramid, if you will. But he's a fully localized being. So what does that mean? You're never going to, in a million years, deal with directly with the top dog. You're just not that important. I'm sorry to say that, but you're just not that important, and rejoice in that. But the reality is you're just going to be dealing with one of his minions, and they're not cute like they are in Despicable Me. They're just evil. Secondly, I think that we need to look at what the Bible says that the enemy can do. What might we expect in the range of evil's activities? And I think painting with the largest umbrella in this that everything else fits under, I would say that the enemy deals in ideology. That is to say that evil works within our world system to create ideas and beliefs and structures and values to lure and coerce people to live without or to move away from God. The enemy brokers in extremes. So if you're in a balanced middle position, he wants to push you over onto the side. If you think that prayer is a really good thing, he wants to make it the only thing. If you think that fasting is great, he wants you to never eat. Do you see what I'm saying? He'll take a religious thing that's good and he will move it to its extreme. But the enemy brokers in ideas. That's what accusations are. They're ideas. And so he works ideologically. Now, if we're looking at a compendium or a spectrum, a range, let's just say on the one side, we have temptation, garden variety temptation, let's just say. And that is that evil works in cooperation with our fleshly desires, that's what the Bible says, luring us away from God. Did God really say, you know, if... you know, what's the harm in just clicking on that image, you know, on your computer? What's the harm in that? I mean, you can just click right out of that, and you click, and then you click, and then you click, and you click, and you baby step into bondage. But the enemy loves to work with what we have in us already. And so it's interesting that Jesus says at the end of the Lord's Prayer, lead us not into temptation. That has to do with us. But deliver us from the evil one. So that these are kind of working in concert together. What's wrong with you working with what's wrong with the wrong one, with the evil one. Does that make sense? So that's the first thing. Secondly, from there, the enemy also brokers an accusation. That evil bombards us with lies and falsehood and half-truths, berating and condemning and creating self-hatred. You're worthless. You're ugly. You're despised. You're confused. You're dumb. Whatever it is, pick your poison. The enemy's the accuser. He's the accuser. Thirdly, or fourthly, or wherever we are, because I didn't put numbers down here, he oppresses. That is, evil presses on and pressures and harasses us mentally and emotionally with seemingly no let up. I like the way that one author put it, that evil drives and the shepherd leads. Evil drives and the shepherd leads. The enemy also brokers in affliction. That is what we see here, that he can sometimes push physical illness and disease on us, working in cooperation with our sin and the sins of others. And he's been very good at this for a very long time. Now, this is a word that you won't find anywhere really in the Bible, but I'm trying to describe something with this, and I think you'll get what I mean, that this is infestation. That is to say that evil infests every area that we yield with a strategy overall of total and complete domination. That is to say this, that termites never own a house, but they can take it down nonetheless. That makes sense? And so I would call that infestation, and it happens simply because we yield territory. And then lastly, and this is the only one that I would say that a believer is not subject to, all the rest are, and that is this complete domination or dominion. That is, evil's target is to own every area of your life, like the Gadarene demoniac. Now, that is not a complete, that's just all off the top of my head this morning, but I've taught on this a lot of times, and I love the way that C.S. Lewis balances this. From his book, Screwtape Letters, he said it this way: there are two equal and opposite errors into which our race can fall about the devils. One is to disbelieve in their existence. The other is to believe and to feel an excessive and unhealthy interest in them. They themselves are equally pleased with both errors and hail the materialist and the magician with the same delight. Beautifully said. Now back into the book of Job. Job is miserable. Covered head to toe in sores, courtesy of the spiritual realm, helpless and tormented, he scratches himself, but there is no relief. And you would say that Job is experiencing this alone, but he's not alone. He still has a wife. He lost all of his kids, but he didn't lose his wife. And listen to what she says. Are you still maintaining your integrity? Curse God and die. I mean, this is not exactly helpful, is it? But his wife's the first human to weigh in. Later on, I think it's curious how Job describes it. My breath is repulsive to my wife. And this is not just actually talking about bad breath. This is actually talking about the effects of his own suffering on his loved ones. And that brings us to the third thing that we observe from this chapter, is that our suffering has a collateral, or that word means secondary ripple effect on those close to us. It has a collateral damaging kind of effect, that even though the suffering has an isolating effect on us, on the people that are close to us, they're enduring this at close range. And sometimes they say things that just are not particularly helpful, that they get fed up and they speak things that are just out of their own emotion in this. Perhaps you are a parent or a spouse or a child of someone who is going through a Job-like experience. And I think a lot of us have gone through this, where we have somebody that we love that is going through this really, really tough time, and it's overwhelming to us. We're not going through what they're going through, but we are in some sort of secondhand way experiencing it. If that's you, what are you feeling now? If that's you, how is their suffering impacting you? What is the effect that you are carrying as a result of what's going on with them? What is it? Think for a moment. Because this is not easy stuff. Maybe it's taken you to the end of your rope. I think it's taken Job's wife there. She's just like, I don't know how you can take this anymore. About 17 years ago, I went through a bout of clinical depression. I think the way that I'm composed inside, I need some relational permanence in my life. And when we planted this church, it was just a revolving door of people coming in, us investing in them, and them leaving. People coming in, us investing, them leaving. And each time, a piece of me left with them. And finally, there was not a lot of me left. I was clinically depressed. Everything was dark and oppressive. I was hurting, and I was imploding. I didn't know what to do. I'm going to share this. This will color you with all of the pastors that you know, but oh well, too bad. I was at a pastor's conference up in Lancaster, California. I was staying in a hotel with a bunch of other pastors. I was out. I was just playing handball against the curb. I was that low. And I was in the pool, and one of my friends said, oh, well, I'm on Prozac, and he just said that on the, you know, by and by, and he just kept on talking. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, you're on Prozac? That's an antidepressant, right? He said, yeah. He said, it's the pastor's drug of choice. What? And I'm like, I would be too ashamed to take that. And he goes, wait a minute. And he just yells out to the pool deck, which is full of pastors, probably 30 pastors there. He's like, how many of you are on Prozac? And about two-thirds of them raised their hand. I was just like, what? All of you are that screwed up? Well, I went to my doctor the next week, and I said, you know, I'm experiencing some big-time clinical depression, and I like to think about sometime maybe going on an antidepressant, and I was doing all these, dropping all of these, you know, qualifiers to get out of it, and eventually I just, you know, he said, well, let's just do it now. What? And he sent me out with an antidepressant. I took the antidepressant. I took it for a year, and it took the low out, but kind of also took the tigger out of me as well. And so I had no tigger. It was all kind of just nothing, but I was tiggerless anyway. And so I leveled out. I did a lot of research during that year. I switched it up, and then I switched up to a different antidepressant for another year, and then felt like I was coming out enough that I needed to start to deal with my stuff. The antidepressant was actually not treating the problem. It was just treating the symptoms, and I needed to deal honestly with my stuff. And so I started dealing honestly with my stuff, and I went cold turkey off an antidepressant. Not a good idea. Felt like I was having electrocuted. Up, yeah, it's just not a good idea. And I imagine if we actually took a poll here, and I'm not doing it, that there are a number of you that are on antidepressants here. I'm not ashamed of you, not even a little bit. I could not get out of where I was. On top of that, it was really hard on my family. Because they had to live with me in this non-personhood where I was. And get this, I was a pastor the whole time. I'm standing up and I'm teaching the Word of God every week. I'm counseling people, but I'm tubing it. This is just reality, folks. I'm not pretending. You know that I don't pretend in front of you or behind closed doors. I'm not a pretender. The reality is, I'm so glad that God is generous to me. Because I need him that much. And even having walked with God for 45 years, I still need him more than ever. Maybe I need him more now than I did when I was young. The reality is that when you're going through something like this, it's really hard on the people around you. You know what I'm saying? Alcoholics Anonymous, we have an AA meeting that meets here on Thursday nights. There's another dimension to Alcoholics Anonymous called Al-Anon. It's for all the people that are the spouses and the family members of the people in Alcoholics Anonymous, because there's collateral damage. There's a ripple effect that comes from the things that alcoholics are suffering from. If you have a parent who has Alzheimer's or goes through that, you need support. You need people around you, because the collateral effect of someone going through that kind of suffering is horrendous, and we need each other in this. Am I being clear to you? Trying to be as real and raw as I know. Some of you, that might be like, wow, that's a complete disqualifier. I don't know if I can ever listen to you again. If that's so, that is your problem, not mine. Now, I would say that straight. I don't know a single pastor who isn't screwed up, because I don't know a single human who isn't screwed up. It's our planet. Do you hear what I'm saying? Okay, let me back up. Get a little aggressive. Here. And so in verse 10, here's Job's reply. You are talking like a foolish woman. Shall we accept good from God and not trouble? And in all this, Job did not sin in what he said. In all this, Job did not sin in what he said. Now, several things to note here. The first one is that Job thinks that both good and evil come from God. And I want to ask you, is that right? It's not a trick question. What's happening here is that suffering is testing what Job's thoughts are about God. That suffering Firstly, suffering reveals who we are and dimensions about us that perhaps we've been able to hold down, but it also reveals what we think about God. Now, throughout this entire book, Job is going to cling to some very inadequate and wrong ideas about God and how things work, but this suffering is what exposes it. And it's something that suffering is very unique in, is that it exposes both who we are as people and what we think about God. I've heard people over the years say things like, I'm going through this because God hates me. Have you ever heard anybody say something like that? I mean, I've actually heard a lot of people say that. God could never forgive me for these things that I have done. You don't understand what I have done. He could never forgive me. I'm going through this because he hates me. The book that I'm reading right here, called the Bible, this is actually the testimony of a God who saw an entire race of people so stained, so alienated, so rebellious against him, and he still came after us. Even with all those things completely intact, he came after us. He took on flesh. He sent the very best of heaven to come and rescue us. He loves that much. He loves you that much. And so Job thinks that God is doing this to him. A lot of times when we're going through tough times, we think that God is doing this to us. And I want to ask you the question, is he? And this brings us to perhaps the central question that Job addresses, the book of Job addresses, and that is, what is going on underneath the surface of things? What is going on underneath the surface of things? We ask that about people that we care about and what things that they're going through. That's a great question to ask, isn't it? What is going on underneath the surface of things? That is the question. Now, on the other hand, what I have to surmise from this particular verse in Job is that I see this sort of inadequate views of God, and I also see this beautiful surrender and submission to God concurrently, both at the same time. Bad ideas about God and how things work, and the right attitude at the same time. I see this in him. He submits, he concedes, he yields, he doesn't shake his fist at heaven. Later on, we'll see in chapter 13 of the book of Job, interesting chapter 13, the bankruptcy chapter, that though he slay me, yet will I hope in him. Though he slay me, Job says, yet will I hope in him. I think the thing that gets me about this is that this Job, this is a very good man. This is a very good human being. This is somebody that the Lord esteems, says, wow, have you considered my servant Job? This guy's the real deal, a rare bird. He is so authentic, the real deal. I see this in Job, and I can't help but be filled with admiration. So what do we see from all this? Let me just reiterate before I close. Firstly, from this chapter, as we're dealing with thinking about suffering with faith and truth, that we see that in all of it, that God wants us to be faithful to him. It's a very simple thing, not a very complex thing. He wants us to be faithful to him. Secondly, we saw that invisible evil can inflict physical suffering in the visible world. And as bothersome as that is, it is true. And that our suffering has a collateral ripple effect, a secondary ripple effect on those close to us, on our loved ones. And lastly, that suffering tests our ideas about God. I want to come back to the chief question that we just said just a few moments ago. That in all of this, that suffering surfaces, what we should do is ask the question, what is going on under the surface of things? I think when we do, it's very sobering. Because we ask that question and we exercise a little bit of reflection. Lord, what's going on in, let's just say that you have somebody that's going through some serious suffering in your life and you're walking alongside of them at really close range and it's really difficult. perhaps a question to ask is, Lord, what is this revealing inside of me, and what are you doing through this? If you're the one that's going through the suffering, maybe the right question to ask is, Lord, what's going on under the surface of things? What's demonically driven? What's me? What's others? What's wounds that I've taken? What's my past? What's this world system? What lies have I bought into? What is going on under the surface of things? I want to see things. I want to see you the way that you are. I want to see me the way that I am before you. I want to see things as they really are. Not as I want them to be, but as they are. What is going on under the surface of things? That is the question that Job 2 and Job 1 ask. And I want to ask you to ask that in your own times with God this week. Amen? Let's stand.